It would be nice. All right. Well, since there is no live baseball to talk about, you know, we've kind of had to get a little bit creative with the way we create some content. And I thought Jim Ingram with the Chronicle Telegram, the Medina Gazette, and a special contributor to Forbes did a great job of that yesterday as he went through and he detailed the best Tribe players of each decade. And Jim joins us on the hotline right now. Jim, we appreciate the time as always. And I want to get into this article that you wrote discussing the best Tribe players of each decade. And is it safe to say that at least early on in Indians history, that was a fairly easy list to put together?
Yeah, actually, Andy, it was. I think a lot of people, a lot of Indians fans probably aren't really aware of the fact they only won one World Series in the first 50 years or almost 50 years of the last century. They don't realize how good the Indians really were in the early 1900s. I mean, there were some Hall of Fame caliber guys, and in some cases more than one on the team in those days. And a lot of them just kind of stood out as I went through this and tried to put these lists together. They turned out to be pretty easy decisions. For example, 1901 to 1909, Napoleon Lajoie just kind of ran away with that decade with the Indians. I mean, he had a WAR of 56.7, and the next closest guy was like 35.6. So Lajoie was already he was already considered the best player in the American League when the Philadelphia A's traded him to the Indians, and he continued it on when he was here. I mean, his numbers are pretty astounding. Some of the things he did. I mean, he won the batting title one year. During the decade, he hit .336 and 381 on base, 844 OPS, and he was supposedly a big but a really agile second baseman that was just kind of like the whole baseball package. And you know, as I mentioned in the column, 1 year after he was on the team, they changed the name of the team to the Naps. So, you know, when they name the team after you, you know you're making a pretty good impact.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And while I'm sure it was a little bit easier early on, seems like the further along you went, the harder this really kind of became. And sometimes that's for a good reason, and sometimes it could be for some more challenging reasons. And I think about the 70s and the 80s in particular for the Indians, when it seems like the pickings were pretty slim when putting this list together.
Yeah, they were. In fact, as I was going through all these decades, it pretty much mirrors the success of the team, the players that were the best in each decade, and the competition for that title in each decade. You really get to see the kind of the ups and downs of the franchise. Like, for example, I mean, the first 5 decades, even though they only won the World Series once, they had a Hall of Fame player who was the best guy in all those decades. I mean, after Lajoie in 01 to 09, in 1910 to 19, it was Shoeless Joe Jackson, who's not in the Hall of Fame, but would have been if he hadn't have been banned from baseball with the Black Sox. And then in 1920 to 29, you got Tris Speaker. 30 to 39, Earl Averill, who's one of the more underrated, I think, Indian stars of the time. I looked it up, and I was actually kind of surprised that he was the Indians' career home run leader for almost 60 years until Albert Bell broke his record in 1996, and he was easily the best player from 30 to 39. His WAR was 46.6. Hal Trosky was second at 24.4, but Averill basically led the team in all the significant categories in that decade. And then, of course, you get to the 40s, and Lou Boudreau, far and away, he had a 59 WAR compared to Ken Keltner's 27, and Boudreau, really, his story, I think, is another undertold story in the history of Indians baseball, for sure. I mean, people realize that he was the Indians manager at age 24. He was the youngest guy on the team, and they named him the manager, a player manager, and a shortstop, no less at that. And, of course, he won the MVP award in 1948 when they won the World Series, the last Indians team to do so, by the way. And then you turn the corner in the 50s to get... In 54, of course, you had another pennant-winning team. And in the 50s, Larry Doby was actually it was a close race that year for that decade, Doby was my choice. Al Rosen was right there with him, and so was Bobby Avila. Those three guys were kind of the three finalists there. And then you get into the 60s and 70s where it really thinned out quickly. I mean, for example, Boudreau in the 40s had a WAR of 59. In the 1960s, the top WAR for an Indians player was Woody Held at with 15. So that was when the fallow years, as I call it, started. And then into the 70s, it wasn't good. 80s, it started to pick up a little bit, and then we get to the 90s, and those just blockbuster Indians teams with stars all over the place, it picks up a lot.
Well, let's get right into that decade of the 90s, because in reading through it, I mean, I'm sure you had so many to pick from. When you're talking about that 90s Indians teams, I mean, boy, they had just so many stars on all of those teams, especially as you got into the heart of the decade and the middle of the decade towards the end of it. So Kenny Lofton was the pick in the 90s. For those who haven't had the chance to read the column, we highly encourage all of you to do so. Why Kenny Lofton over some of the others? Because that was a star-studded cast in that decade.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, you try to judge the complete player, not just how good of an offensive player he was. And Lofton was my choice. Tommy was second, and Albert Bell was third. And Kenny was just a better all-around player than those other two guys, and that's obviously not to take anything away from either of them. I mean, Tommy's in the Hall of Fame, and Albert would have been probably if he hadn't had to retire prematurely because of a bad hip. But, I mean, Kenny played on a lot of those teams, most of those teams, really, with the exception of 97 when he got traded to Atlanta and then came back to Cleveland the following year. And I mean, he led the Indians in that decade in runs, hits, triples, stolen bases, batting average, and he was really kind of, as we all know, those of us who lived through it, the table setter for that ferocious Indians lineup that was really kind of uncontrollable for opposing pitchers. It just was wave after wave of hitters. I remember when I was doing my Hargrove book, talking to him about that lineup, and he said other teams' managers and players constantly told him that there was no let up in that lineup. I mean, you're going to walk Tommy to face Bell, or you're going to walk Bell to face Eddie Murray, and right on down the line. So it was really was a formidable lineup. And but I went with Lofton mainly because of the all around player. He's a terrific outfielder. You know, he stole a lot of bases and he could hit 300, and he was pretty much the whole package. Tommy, you know, was an adequate defensive player and a huge slugger, and the same could be said of Bell. But when you talk about both sides of the ball and just the all-around contributor, I think Kenny contributed in more ways than the other two did.
Now, Jim, I was all of 4 years old when the 90s came to a close, so this next decade in the 2000s is when my interest in Cleveland Indians baseball really peaked. And your selection here, Grady Sizemore, a guy that a very young Rocco Nucci tried to model his Little League career after, how does he get the nod here over CC Sabathia and Travis Hafner?
Well, again, I think it was the totality of Sizemore's game. I mean, he was again a Gold Glove center fielder. He could steal bases. He had power. He defensive player, and just was. I think one of the great tragic things of the Indians' recent history was that he didn't get a chance to have a healthy career from start to finish. Because I think he would have been like right there with the greatest players in the franchise. Maybe I recall there was one of those years in that era when he was at his peak. Sports Illustrated had him on the cover, and Mark Shapiro, who was the president of the team at the time, I think called him the future of the game, or some kind of laudatory comment like that. And he really was. He played hard all the time. He was a great guy. You know, he didn't have to worry about him off the field, and he had. He could steal bases. He could run down fly balls in the gaps. He could really do everything, and it was just unfortunate that he wasn't able to play out his entire career. I mean, by the age he was done because of the injuries, before he was even 30 years old. So, when most players are entering their prime, he had back and knee injuries that just wouldn't stop. But he was a you know, in my opinion anyway, the best all around player of that decade. And you know, Hafner was right there second, I believe, in that group. And you know, Victor Martinez was in that group too. That was when the franchise was still not like it was in the 90s, but there were still especially in the early 2000s. There, they were still pretty formidable, and then we get to the last decade, 2010 to 2019, and you know that's my choice was Carlos Santana, mainly because longevity. I mean, he was on the team longer than Lindor and Ramirez, who were real close behind him in my top three for that one. And I really, as I wrote in a column, I really will always believe that the Indians should have won the World Series at some point in that decade with the pitching that they had. And you know, Santana and Lindor and Ramirez, you know, and Lindor and Ramirez were two of the best players in all of baseball, really, at their positions. So it's really unfortunate that they weren't able to win the World Series, because that team was built, especially with the pitching. And, you know, Kluber was a big guy, obviously, in that group, too. So they had the pitching, they had the offense, they had the defense. They really, that was a World Series winning caliber team throughout several of those years, and they just weren't able to complete the job.
Again, we're being joined on the hotline by Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram, the Medina Gazette, and a special contributor as well to Forbes. And well, that last decade, that was so interesting to me, because I think anybody that looks at that, they would think that even based on the numbers, that would be a slam dunk. It would have to be Frankie Lindor. But as you pointed out in the article, Santana has a better overall WAR in that decade. And it's fascinating how Santana kind of becomes a more obvious answer to the guys that follow all of the analytics, because analytically speaking, with the new age, Santana kind of does everything. He checks all the boxes that you look for offensively. He's really not much of a slouch defensively either at first base. And, you know, I think back, Jim, to all that Santana has done for the franchise, and to think that all it really cost the Indians to get Carlos Santana was Casey Blake. That was it.
Yeah, and that's a good example, actually, of what the Indians have really been best at, I would say, over the last, gosh, going back to the late 90s, I would say. They've always been good at identifying good players in other teams' minor league systems and acquiring them and having them come to Cleveland and have, you know, some of their best years. And Santana certainly was the case there. The one thing I will also mention, WAR is but one of the factors that contributes to a WAR figure is longevity. And Carlos has played with the Indians longer than Lindor and Ramirez has. So, I mean, the number I have for WAR in the decade for Santana was 28, and Lindor was at 27, and Ramirez was at 25. So that's pretty close. And really, the only difference is Carlos played a year or two more than the other two guys. But, I mean, those are the three core guys. And you're right, Carlos has really been kind of an underappreciated star that the analytics people do like, because he draws a lot of walks. He always has a high on-base percentage, and he'll hit some home runs. So, those are the things they like to see most analytics people do right now. And Carlos checks all those boxes, and he's a dependable guy too. He's very seldom has he been injured. He's pretty much, you can pencil him in for 150 games, 155 every year. So that's another big factor in his favor.
Well, and let's hope that we get to see more of Carlos Santana, whether it be for the rest of this year or, I don't know, maybe magically they can come to some sort of agreement with Santana to get him to pick up his option for next year. But, you know, Jim, while we're on that topic, I'd be curious to get your thoughts on what's going on with these ongoing negotiations between the owners and the Players Association. I mean, this is just a real bad look for the game in the court of public opinion, and would just like to get your thoughts on what's going on here over the last 3 or 4 weeks.
Well, I think baseball is the worst run sport in the country, actually. What's going on now, it should be embarrassing beyond belief to both teams, because it's embarrassing to those of us, you know, who are watching it. And then the fact that, you know, they can't reach an agreement on this when all the other sports have, and they're still fighting over money. And it's just unfortunate that it's come to this. But, you know, these are two sides that have a long history of acrimony towards one another. And you know, the right now the players are dug in and the owners are dug in, and it's almost like, you know, nothing else matters in their mind. I don't think either side has a real sense for the optics of this thing, how this looks, especially given the times we're in right now and all the problems in other areas that everyone is having. And you know, you've got this sport that traditionally owns the summertime every year, going back into the 1800s, dragging its feet and just kind of, making faces at each other and not getting anything done to get the game back on the field. So I think both teams should really be embarrassed by the whole thing. And in a sport that's already seen its attendance go down for the last 10 years, I believe it is, this is going to do nothing to add interest to the game. It's once again, they're shooting themselves not in the foot, and I would say in both feet, the way they're behaving now. So I don't know if it's going to result in baseball being played or not being played, but the damage done to this point, I think, is enough for both sides should be very concerned about it.
Yeah, it's hard to argue that, because you do have a lot of people, at least on many social media platforms, saying just that, that they've already kind of lost them based on the way they've gone back and forth here the last few weeks. Well, Jim, as always, we appreciate the time. We always appreciate the insight as well. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will definitely catch up again soon.
Okay, Andy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jim. Again, that's Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram, the Medina Gazette, and a special contributor to Forbes as well.